When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's the Drink Talking with the Thinking Drinkers, Ben McFarland and Tom Sandon. And mistress of wine, Sam Capon. All the booze news and views. From absinthe to Zinfandel. Just imbibers.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to It's the Drink Talking. This is happening once again. My name is Ben McFarland. I'm one half of the Thinking Drinkers. The other half of the Thinking Drinkers is next to me. His name is Tom Sandham. Say hello, Tom.
Hello, I am here. I'm here.
Good. Hey. Sam Capon, the mistress of wine, a master of wine, only 300 and so.
60 odd.
It's probably growing. Have they lowered the barrier to entry? They must be.
Is it a bit like A-levels? Like, do they have a thing like, oh, it was so much easier this year? I imagine it gets harder because there are more wines. But...
Well, I've only sat at the one, so I can't really comment, and I'm not on the examination.
Is it like a driving test? If you fail it, can you do it again?
Yeah, again and again and again.
And you hit it first time?
Yes, actually. Thanks for mentioning it. Under 1% of people do, actually.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So it's generally quite tough. So I did get the exams first time.
Oh, good. But, all right, that's enough. Yeah. That's enough now.
Yeah, the Wine, Spirits and Education Trust do a spirits test. Takes 2 days.
Yeah.
No, actually, that has got harder since really tough now.
Generally, I think it has got harder. I think they've made the diploma harder to make it less of a transition from the diploma up to the Master of Wine. And throughout the years, they've definitely made it harder. Like, you didn't have to do a dissertation, now you do. They've introduced some new papers into the theory section.
Well, I started that podcast with quite a lot of energy and sucked out of it. Yes or no answer would have been good. Never mind.
What's going on, Ben? What's going on in your world? What's made you angry?
There's two things. What's turned me on? Well, it's called Spit or Swallow. And my spit is going to be pubs. Can people start going to the bloody pub, please? Ooh. Because they're all closing. And apparently between...
I sent you a link for that. Did you get it?
Yeah, I did. Thanks.
Is that what this is?
That was our little secret. Now, stop going to artisan coffee chains and buying crap cups of brown muck. If you're going to work in a coffee shop on your little laptop, do it in a pub, buy some beer, because there are 35 million fewer pints were sold in pubs between July and September this year as opposed to last year.
Crikey.
That's a lot of pints.
That's the worst figures in 5 years. And pubs are closing. They're getting hammered left, right and centre. Business rates. Oh, I'm not going to go into business rates. It's more boring than talk of diplomas. But business rates are... And many, many cases, absolutely caning pubs, because business rates are sort of calculated every few years, I think about every 10 years, I think, roughly. And to cut a long story short, dull one, business rates are based entirely on how much money a pub makes. And then they go, right, you make this much money, you've got to contribute to... Please,
they need to do that every year, don't they?
Well, they should do, yeah. But also the
especially
way
pubs, if there's 35 million less.
Yeah, but they've changed
sold.
The criteria a little bit on how these are judged, and it's not been favourable for pubs. Mm. And more of these big brands are taking all their shops out into industrial sort of out town shopping zones, and so are not getting hit with those business rates. And so the people picking up the can are small businesses on the high street that keeping communities alive, pubs are integral. And I mean, for instance, Tom, there was a place in St Albans, a pub called the Boot.
Yeah, I know.
Do you know
Boots.
The Boot?
Yeah. So proper old traditional building as well. That's traditional building. Did you say that? It's an old building.
It's a traditional building. It's got four walls and a
roof. Yeah, it has a door.
So the pub's business rates increased by 280%.
That's got to be on rateable value of the, yeah, the space, though. The,
yeah, yeah.
The
I mean, but St Albans house price has gone up.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah,
they've gone to paying from 14 grand a year business rates to 53 grand.
Christ.
And that's now, a lot that's of pints of beer you need to sell to cover that.
Do you know how many?
No, how many? 35 million?
No, 22,000 pints he's got to sell extra.
More. Extra.
But he's opposite the Fleur-de-Lis, which is a pub where Simon Evans used to drink.
Oh, yep.
You remember he said that? And then it's opposite another pub called the Vintry, which is a pub no more, because we used to drink in there, and they turned it into a coat. Because actually, early bird special in the coat.
A coat and a boot.
Yeah.
What and it was a vestry.
So two quick questions then. Actually, just one quick question.
Yeah.
Why...
It's not
has.
Quick, is it? Hurry up.
But why has it gone up so much? Why have they revalued it so much? Why has it gone from 15 to 50?
It's missing. I blame Margaret Thatcher. No, I don't know why. And what I find depressing is that when these pubs have gone, they're gone.
Mm.
There's a pub near me that's closed. It is, I'm not going to say the name of it, but it was a well-renowned place to get crystal meth, heroin and crack.
And now it's gone.
And quite frankly...
Where am I going to get it?
Yeah.
The community is suffering.
No, I mean, those pubs like that, okay, probably deserve to change hands or close down. You go into the town centres and there's pubs that during the day are totally empty. You go into a coffee shop and it's packed.
Mm.
And people are fighting over plugs and... working and all the yummy mummies there.
So, you know, there is a reason for that, though.
Why? What is the reason?
Alcohol. You can't be just sitting caning beers in the middle of the day.
No,
trying to get some work done.
What's drinking a pint
Well, not only that. I'm just saying, go and have a coffee.
Wow. Like the pub.
Go and have a coffee in a pub.
Yeah.
This is as much to do with pubs not doing things to attract the coffee crowd. But the pub that won the Observer Pub of the Year has a hairdresser in there. It's got coffee mornings. It really, I think, it's a
actually,
post office as well.
That's a really
that is a responsibility on the shoulders of the pub.
Absolutely,
you know what?
Absolutely,
in terms
pubs
of sweating,
do more, maybe, yes, as part of it.
In terms of sweating a space, I think that's a really interesting point because there's. Place in my village, and they really are smart. They do coffees and pastries in the day. They do lunch, and they were just doing beers initially. Now they do food. They do crochet lunches. They do Cuban dancing. They've got bands, poetry evenings.
They've become a centre of the community again.
Yeah, so there's something for everyone.
That's kind of where
they're
coming from.
But then also, you've just got to... Even if you do all that, if you really work hard to create all these, to fill the pub throughout the day, if you're getting hit with a massive hike rate, hiking business rates rather.
And do you think that's a London-centric thing?
No, I think, some rates are coming down. Some pubs are paying less because the rateable value is reduced. But the ones that are being hiked up massively. And it is a problem. And the Lib Dems...
God love them.
They're right back in fashion these
days. Yeah, yeah. But they've tabled a motion where they want to cap... rises to 12.5%. I know this is not great listening, folks, but it's important because it's not just...
We all love having a pub.
It's small businesses. Mm. And in light of this, the Paradise Papers? Is that what they're called?
Yeah.
You just think everyone's getting battered.
Yeah.
And the people who can't afford it, and they're the lifeblood of the communities. And, you know, there's people who are lonely, and pubs are good places for people to go. They are hubs of communities, and they need to be, even from a historical perspective, we need to be going, look, we can't let these things go.
Mm.
And I know some blood splattered tanking house full of crystal meth, then okay,
maybe that's
fine.
The
best thing to do is to perhaps put a tax on crystal meth.
Turn that into a Nero.
So I just think it's,
we'll just go to the pub because if we don't do it, no one will. There's a Nero opposite a pub, a Fuller's pub, that does good coffee, and the idea that Nero, where you can't get a seat in the mornings, that people would go across to the Fuller's is alien to them. So the first step might be just see what your local pub is doing, and if your thing is coffee, I mean, they've got an incredible coffee machine in there with people who are trained to use it. There's no doubt that their coffee is good, and they can make...
They've got a kitchen where they can make an actual bacon sandwich,
not one of those packet things that's just delivered en masse to Nero's around the UK.
The thing is, Tom... We don't need another Nero.
We don't need another Nero.
So there we are, pubs. Go to them, they're nice. That's essentially my spit.
Wow.
And
love
stop
it.
Taxing them and just making
Leave
their lives
alone.
Difficult.
Yes. Enough if not a pioneer.
Enough already.
Yeah, thanks. My swallow is monks. Monks. We're going to get some monkey business back in the brewing scene in Britain. Now,
Dorothy, my legend of liquor is a monk today.
Well, that's wow. fine.
Have you been copying me?
No. Well, Jesus, well if I have been, then you're going to have to change it. Because historically, monks and nuns brewed beer in Britain until Henry VIII had a bit of trouble with the ladies.
He did.
Dissolution of the monasteries, 1536.
Well,
too much kissy. Just too much.
Well, actually, it was 1536 to 1541. It was a 5-year process.
It took quite a while to kill those people.
Yeah. They had a lot of shit.
It's efficient.
It's pretty efficient.
Iconoclasm.
Iconoclasm.
Yeah. So he ruined it all, and brewing went into the hands of the lay people. And
he was probably a bit of a knobhead.
I think there'd be a few of his lady friends, hashtag
me
too.
Yeah, big time. Let's not make light of that.
No, we're not. He actually killed them. I mean, that is bad.
Yeah, but I mean, back then, different times. You different know, we've all done it.
Different cut their heads times.
Off. I mean, they do nag.
Just.
Yeah, there's one easy way to stop that.
But anyway, it means that brewing is no longer done by monks. However, there is a monastery in Leicestershire called the Abbey of Mount St. Bernard, which is not an instruction for any people who are into that kind of thing.
Bernard, you don't
Mount
hear that
St.
name.
Bernard.
So it's it must be an older one. You don't hear the name Bernard any more than you do.
No.
Desmond
or what? Or Keith's or
Nigel's.
Nigel's.
So they've been given the green light by the local authority to build a brewery within the walls of the monastery. So they could become the next Trappist brewery. They're replacing a dairy that was closed due to falling milk prices, which is utterly ridiculous.
Oh, my God.
And it was mooted that they were going to be freezing the price on milk, but that hasn't happened. So milk is simply isn't the cash cow that
one
was.
Jersey. Did you just come up with that on the hoof?
No, of course he didn't.
Oh, come on, Sam.
That's good.
That's just...
Yeah.
Ted?
Yes. Are they,
Pat on the back for Ben.
Yes.
For those puns. Thanks,
very good. So they're going to build a brewery, and they could become the 12th Trappist brewery in the world. This is a Trappist beer, and a Trappist beer means you have to brew the beer within the walls of the monastery, when they're using the old bit for the dairy. They have to be brewed by monks. They're there.
It has to be brewed by monks.
They
and
have to
genuine
do it.
Monks. You can't just farm some people in, stick them in
no,
a Cossack,
I don't think
and off
it
you
is.
Go.
It's not exclusively, but monks have to be
How do
integral.
They know they're real monks?
Well, they've got like a habit. They're a ball patch.
Quiet. They
look
quite
like Gargamel.
Quiet. They don't say much.
If they fulfil those criteria and have to give money from the profits from the sales of those beers to good causes and for the upkeep of the monastery. So,
is that the same with all Trappist profits? Yes, as in there aren't any?
To qualify across the board as a
Trappist
beer.
But it's not
so
just
the
beer.
Monks basically do the brewing and make the beer to basically farm that cash back into good causes.
Yeah, good causes. But also to
maintain...
That's
a shout out for buying a Trappist beer.
It's not entirely so much as they use it for the upkeep of the monastery and for their living expenses as well. So,
and then what's left it goes into...
Yeah. But I mean, they can't be spending that much.
No, have you seen
some
Catholic churches recently?
They're all quite podgy though, aren't they?
Yeah.
Monks.
They are.
quite fat chaps. So they obviously have a good diet of...
Yeah, but...
So probably do
But
all
they
right.
are praying a lot. It's quite
it's
sedentary.
Not upset, yeah. Mm.
Anyway, so they could become the 12th Trappist monastery in the world. They're building a brewery and then they're going to get the guys in and go, look, we're going to brew this beer by us within the walls of the monastery. We're going to give some money to a dolphin orphanage or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's going to be good. And then they're going to get the accreditation. And then we're going to have a Trappist beer back in the UK.
Wow.
There's currently no Trappist beers
no,
in the
there's,
UK.
No, there's...
How many are there outside the sort of Belgian...
Six in Belgium. So you've got Westfalateren, which is kind of considered the best,
that's
the most
I've
exclusive.
Been there. That's the silent monks.
The Orval, Rochefort, Westmalle, Chimay and Aschel. Two in the Netherlands, La Trappe and Zundert. And then there's one in Austria, Italy and US. There's even one in America.
Oh, there is?
Spencer.
Okay. So this isn't that...
But you can make... There's Trappist makeup and there's Trappist... Cheese.
Trappist makeup.
Yeah.
What do they test it on?
I don't know. Orphans? Rabbits?
Mice. They probably got it on mice.
Yeah,
the monks. I imagine get stuck
in. Do you need to test makeup on anything?
Yeah.
Of course you bloody do.
Can't put it on your skin. Do they test it on each other? That's what I'm getting at. Because they are wearing dresses.
They are.
They are forward thinking characters, these monks.
So anyway.
I wouldn't be rushing to buy a Trappist lipstick.
No, I mean, I wouldn't say.
I mean, well, they're making that in the monastery?
I think we've probably tugging at a thread that Ben hasn't done his homework on. And he could even have misread that.
No. I could have been made up.
Yay.
I don't
know.
There's no foundation for that
story.
Yeah,
that's good. There's... Don't get lippy.
You're plucking at a loose there.
I think that's excellent.
So, yes, which is quite exciting.
That's good.
I'm really into that.
So, they're sort of originally Benedictine and called Bernard Beer. Did you know that St. Bernard dog, thing with the...
The gorgeous, fluff, big, massive mountain.
Bit of an urban myth, isn't it?
It is a myth. They never did carry their whiskey around or brandy.
It would dehydrate people in those situations.
So there we go. Anyway, right. So it's all going to be downhill from there after my bit, but let's keep trudging through.
Let's just keep battling on, because I'm going to taste something that's going to bring us back.
Okay.
From the...
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is It's the Drink Talking.
We are tasting tequila! Arriba. Which, I don't know, is that a bit...
It's cliched at the moment.
It's just a bit of a lazy stereotype. Sorry, tequila, because tequila is much more refined than that. Tequila is having its moment in the sun.
Oh, it just keeps on going.
Yeah, sorry. Tequila, bad reputation. What do we think
tequila
of tequila?
Tequila Mockingbird is what I keep thinking.
What do you think of tequila?
I don't like it at
all. Yes, brilliant. Good. We've got someone to convert. We will convert you, Sam. Why don't you like it?
To my mind, it comes with a side portion of salt, lemon and vomit.
Yeah, okay.
And shame, I imagine, on your
deep shame. But at least you probably don't remember it. Because you've probably
Had
it at the end of a night and you've been drinking and someone suggests it right at the end of the night. Let's have a shot of tequila.
Well, largely, although I have to admit, I've got a new gaggle of mum friends because my son's at school and there are some real tequila queens in that crowd. And the tequila comes out surprisingly early before dinner.
Yeah. And the fact that tequila is even in these conversations is one of the reasons it's had such a poor reputation over the last 50 years, really, in this country.
Because it's a binge drinking.
It's associated with a moment in your drinking diets that's just so inappropriate. It's had to do a lot of hard work since the 1950s, tequila, to try and change that around. And to be fair, it's been sold cheaply and it's been drunk in that way. But there's been a lot of work by the industry over there to build a sort of set of rules and regulations about how it's produced and improve the quality of it so that now we should be reappraising this spirit.
So two things again. One, so obviously tequila made well and in an artisan way is for drinking slowly and enjoying, not just as a shot. And I wonder why tequila, like I'd never go to the pub or you wouldn't be in a bar and have a shot of rum.
Which
you know,
it comes down to price.
Yeah.
And
why is it tequila? Is it
it's got this vibe as a party spirit, hasn't it? And but it was priced in a way that made it accessible to everyone at the end. I think Sambuca came in after tequila, really, and took that moment. And we have a drinking culture in this country as well, which seemed to dictate that at the end of the night we'd had our capacity of 10 pints or 2 bottles of wine, and we couldn't drink any more of that, so we needed a shot of something. And it was just there. It was affordable, and people just went to it. They liked to mix it with the lime, and it was a ritual, ritual that the Mexicans have never, never indulged in.
So I wonder where that whole salt and lemon thing came from.
Well, the idea of having salt and citrus around your tequila is not completely alien. It's just that in terms of licking some salt and lime at the same time, I mean, they would have it next to a shot of tomato
sangrita.
Sangrita, yeah. Mm. So they would mix it with savoury as well. It's a sweet product. And not a lot of people think
it's
of it as sweet.
The agave plant.
Well, it's at the heart of this.
Yes.
Today, tequila is still made with the agave at the heart of it, the blue agave. These blue agaves have to specifically be used in the production of it. They're grown in limited areas.
And is tequila always from Mexico?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, they're grown. In fact, the blue agave have to be grown in very specific parts of Mexico.
Jalisco is not a place called Tequila.
Yes.
Yeah, there is. There's a town called Tequila.
See, I never knew that.
There you go.
Yeah.
This
is sort of the heartland of where all the producers are based. So the tequila town is where a lot of the producers are based, and this is in the centre of the Jalisco region where the agaves predominantly grow. Today we're going to have two highland tequilas. There's another region called the lowland region of Jalisco, and both of those regions create something different in terms of the agaves, so different amounts of sugar. A lot of sugar in the agaves, they're baked. Traditional methods are still used in a lot of production, though. They have a tahona stone, which will then crush these agaves in some instances, which used to be pulled around by a horse and tractors as well these days, more so than animal cruelty. And so there's a lot of rugged, rustic, artisan techniques still used. All these agaves picked by hand by the jimadores.
Jimadores.
They are
very sexy men.
They can pick up to 100 of these things a day, which, I mean, we've both
sexy?
Had a...
Well,
just tough.
Oh, they're big.
They're big
blokes.
Mexicans, like, you know, what makes a Mexican man unsexy? He's big and tough. He's got a big moustache.
Have you both been?
Yeah, yeah, we both had a go at picking them, and they're very different. They grow over 7 years, these things, and they have spiny leaves, and the leaves are very sharp.
Mm.
They look a bit like, in that respect, and that's why people think they are a cactus, but they're not. They're a flowering plant, but they cut the flower off to keep the sugars all within the bulb of the plant. And then they have to cut off these really sharp, I mean, they're razor sharp spines on the leaves.
And so they have like these big shin pads.
Yeah.
And it's like a big pizza cutter.
It's
very hard work, especially in the middle of a baking sun in Mexico. And we both of us have had a go at this and managed a couple of leaves in about an hour. And they do 100 of these things.
It's so prickly.
It's really prickly.
I was like, oh, ow!
And their tool is so sharp. So, yeah, go to 100% agave tequilas, which means they've used 100%
blue
agave.
Because it
will say it on the bottle. It has to say it. If it's a proper tequila, 100% agave, you can see it on this bottle. Here we've got Don Julio.
100% puro agave.
Yeah, and the Oche tequila. Both of them 100%
40%
agave.
Alcohol.
Yeah. Go with 100% agave because you're going to get a lot of the agave flavors. And agave is delicious. So the first thing we're going to have is Ocho, as in the number 8. Ocho tequila. It's produced by Carlos Camarena. And he's a very important man in the tequila industry, third generation tequiliero. And he partnered up with a guy called Thomas Estes, who's the European ambassador of tequila and has done a hell of a lot of work. We're fans of Thomas. He's done a lot of work to promote tequila.
And to raise awareness and stop people abusing it, essentially.
Yes. So he's worked with Carlos and to create this, and it's single estate tequila. Now, what that means is we talk a bit about terroir in tequila and highland, lowland. Highland are going to be a slightly sweeter tequila, lowland a bit more earthy. But he goes to different fields, plants his agaves in different fields.
Why is it sweeter if you're higher up?
Because the air's thinner. It's about 2,000 feet above sea level. So the agave, much like grapes, has to work a bit harder. So it produces more residual sugars. But he goes to different fields. So this is a reposado tequila. And what it means is that depending on the harvest and what he gets out of it, it will vary. Vintages, if you you like, which does mean that there's a bit more thought going into it, a bit more of a conversation about it. It's not just a mass-produced tequila. And we're going to try Reposado because I thought, I did come in here thinking, Sam, you are possibly not going to be a fan.
So, sorry, Reposado is like a vintage. It's a quality thing.
Ocho is the vintage tequila brand. They're doing vintages. No one else is really doing this. Reposado is the category of tequila, so it's been aged. It's been rested.
And what's the deal with the worm?
There's no worm.
But what's the history of that?
It was put in there to prove that the actual larva, which is what it is, of a blight that would attack the agaves, was put in there to show that it had a certain percentage of alcohol so that it wouldn't deteriorate, so you could look at your bottle and know that it was a quality alcohol level. So, yeah, the stories about it making you hallucinate, etc., are
nonsense.
Total bullshit. So this is a Reposado. So that means it's been aged. Aged for a minimum of 2 months in oak. This Ocho has been aged for 8 weeks and 8 days, I believe they say. Now, smell it. What do you get on the nose? What's kind of piney. Yeah, a little bit of pine, probably from the American oak.
I just smell tequila. This must be how people would start tasting wine. I just smell wine. Yeah. I now have utter sympathy. I just smell tequila and a bit of pine.
I think that's really lovely floral. I think it's got peach in there.
Yeah, it's almost honeyed as well because it's really promising something sweet.
What I would say is I'm more surprised by the viscosity.
Yeah, okay.
It's got a nice texture.
Yeah. Have you tasted it?
I've taken the world's smallest sip.
You haven't been sick.
Come on, Sam.
There is a lot of depth of flavour to this. We could have gone in on Blancos. This is the first time we've done tequila on the podcast, but I wanted to introduce you to something that's just had a bit of time in oak.
But also, it doesn't have any of that shudder factor that you get with this.
None at all.
Really, okay, I have to admit, I barely put it to my lips. I'll have a proper sip.
And not only that, it's just, there's a smoothness to it as well. And it's got a bit of heat, but at no point do you just think, oh.
Okay, you're getting there.
That's quite interesting. Oh, get the spice and the finish. Yes. Given the fact that actually I hadn't swallowed it before, I'm entirely
that
honest.
Does help.
So. I had just put it to my lips. I'm going to have another sip.
I think the beauty of it is it tastes of agave, doesn't it, Ben? That's what I get. Actually, rather than tasting of something that's mixed,
I do get the shudder.
I do still get the shudder.
But that's got more to do with your past.
It could be psychological. It could be a psychological reaction.
Oh, okay.
My two takeouts on that are, love the smoothness. I like the sweetness. I like the glycerine. And now I've actually dared to swallow any, I would say like the spice. I can now pick up the oak.
Brilliant. I think we're getting there. And we started with that one.
Very
it's a bit
pleasant aftertaste as well.
Can you imagine that? Sat on a veranda in Mexico, some guacamole, tortilla chips. More cliches, ladies and gentlemen.
Gun in your holster.
Licking out this guns tummy button as a hunky Mexican picker.
Yep.
You disgust me.
Sort of looking at a bedraggled donkey in your yard. No, and also drinking that. It's really nice and chilled. I totally get it.
Yeah.
And this kind of good gear would only be drunk... pure.
I think you could
never
learn from that.
Squeeze a lime in.
With our shows, we do a lot of neat spirit tasting. And all we're asking, I think, for people who listen to us is to try it neat first. Then you can do whatever you like with it. But I think if you try it neat first, you'll be surprised.
It's actually quite tasty.
Okay, well, you're going to step up onto the Don Julio now.
Don Julio.
Which has spent a little bit more time in oak. And I wanted to start with the Ocho because it's been 8 weeks. And this Don Julio's...
It's got a colour.
Well, yeah, because it's spent 8 months. Ooh. 8 months in the oak.
It smells much more mellow and like honey and spice. honey. I get honey.
Brilliant. Okay, so we're stepping up. And this is only the Reposado. So this is, I'll try to be a bit of a range within the Reposado category. And you step up again into Añejo, and that will spend a minimum of 12 months in...
Into what?
Añejo.
I've been watching Narcos, but I like they all have deep voices. Bebida.
Añejo. Añejo. Tequila. Except when they say tequila.
Yeah. That's got to be said in a very high-pitched voice.
We're still not going in a good direction with this. Don Julio, anyway. Don Julio was a man. He's sadly no longer with us. Died relatively recently. He is a pioneer of the world of tequila. He came to tequila with ideas on agriculture and started growing as a agaves a certain distance apart because he wanted to give them more exposure to sunshine. This was seen as quite a pioneering process. He wanted to get the heart of the piña, which is the bulby part of the agave that they roast. He slow roasted them, 72-hour cycles. Lots of passion about his piñas. And then he has beautiful piñas. Bearing in mind, he puts them in an American oak barrels for 8 months. That's four times what the sort of the industry standard would be. So as a result, should have a bit more influence of the wood, maybe a bit more mellow, maybe a bit more elegant, maybe a little bit more sweeter. They also, in both cases, actually, and the Camarena family are famous for using wild yeast strains, as excite you, Ben.
Love a bit of yeast.
And they use their own proprietary yeast strain. Another thing to say about those mixed doses, they might use a sort of standard industry yeast. These guys, they look after their yeast. They're very passionate about yeast as well. So Don Julio goes to all these extra lengths. It's in a beautiful bottle as well.
Can I just say quickly, pricing? Like, is tequila expensive?
Good tequila is expensive in as much as you're going to pay between £30 and £40 for a good bottle of Reposado. However, that tequila comes for about £23. It's in only in a 50cl, the Ocho, only in a 50cl
And the
bottle.
Don Julio?
I don't know what that retails for. It will be more expensive. That Don Julio spent 8 months in American barrels. It takes 7 years to grow one agave plant. They need quite a hefty amount of them just to make one bottle of tequila. So if you think about that, they're hand-picked agaves, which it takes a hell of a lot of effort.
And they squeeze
baked,
them? Or?
They bake them, then they crush them. So, I mean, if you're going to pay 40 quid for a bottle of anything and you want stories and real artisan commitment to it, tequila is one of the few genuine categories. That
also, if you go there, it's amazing because the soil there in the region, in Jalisco, is this bright sort of reddish soil.
Yeah.
And then you've got these really bright blue agave plants.
And how big are the plants?
They're massive. The bulb itself, I mean, you wouldn't be able to lift, but the leaves are... You wouldn't be able to lift. I can lift, but you're a woman. But the leaves, ladies. I mean, it's not work for girls.
No.
No, but they are. They're huge things. I could lift them, but then I am as strong as a lady.
But they are... they're not cactus, like a fork-shaped... Mm.
There's a picture. We'll put a picture on our Instagram with our hashtag It's the Drink Talking. So if people want to see that,
thanks, Tom.
I preferred the first one.
You preferred the first one. Interesting. Well, we haven't actually talked about the flavour of the Don Julio.
Okay,
just
come
to
on
say
then.
For listeners, soft,
I get more
elegant.
Shudder reaction to the
it's
second one.
It's got the oaky parts. It's got caramel in there. Best served neat. So that's Don Julio. And
I liked both. I think it showed just in two tequilas the kind of differences you can have.
And they're both available on whiskeyexchange.com.
If you can go to Mexico and see how they drink it there, then it's suddenly you get an epiphany where you go, oh, I see now.
That's good gear.
And again, and when you bring it back, it's like, wow. This is still good gear.
It's
yeah.
not Ouzo.
No, it's not Ouzo. So thank you, Tom. I think that's not going to be the only tequila tasting we do because there's so much to explore.
We'll step back to Blanco and we'll get to Añejo and Extra Añejo where you're paying £100 plus a bottle. So don't worry. We'll get to some of the stuff I drink on private jets.
Yeah.
It just doesn't want to waste that on you just yet.
So thank you very much. That was informative and entertaining.
And it amazing. Made me a little bit shit-faced.
Yes, yes. Quite strong.
Quite strong.
Okay, Sam, now it's your turn to tell everyone about A Legend of Liquor. And I just hope it's not about monks, because we've already done monks in the podcast.
Is
it about monk?
It's monk-related.
Okay.
Yeah, it's Dom Perignon.
No.
You could argue was a monk.
Was he or was he a hermit?
No, he was a monk.
Oh, all right. Well, it's not arguing. There he was.
It was a very brief argument.
Well, it's kind of two,
slash,
actually.
Yeah, okay. If there's time.
Slash Christopher Merritt.
I do need a slash.
No, you don't slash. I was just thinking that. Moving on. So have you boys heard of a guy called Christopher Merritt? M-E-R-R-E-T.
No.
You could always add an extra T on as well. No. So basically, this is all about the origins of sparkling wine and who discovered actually putting the sparkle into champagne or sparkling wine.
So making it sort of commercial and keeping it rather than the idea that fermentation brings carbonation.
Who's credited with the invention of sparkling wine? And basically, it's pretty much Dom Perignon. he is who has been largely credited with the invention of champagne throughout the years. But actually, I think that's been proven to be a load of bollocks.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So it's a great marketing tool. It's an amazing story. It's quite romantic. Obviously, the top prestige cuvee at Moët is named Dom Pérignon after Dom Pérignon. But actually, it wasn't him. It was a guy in England about 30 years before who managed to write a paper that he presented to the Royal Society in 1662 called Some Observations Concerning the Ordering of Wines. Fascinating title.
So fascinating. I instantly forgot.
It just left me with no emotion whatsoever.
I don't think I know what you said. Really. It was just blah, 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 blah.
Where he talked about adding sugar and molasses to make wines drink brisk and sparkling. So, i.e., how to make wines fizzy. But interestingly, there's a guy who was part of the same order, I guess, as Dom Pérignon, you know, years later, who basically big upped sort of Dom Pérignon and spun this whole kind of backstory about him to try and kind of throw light and kudos onto the monastery. But actually, Dom Pérignon was amazing. But back in the day when he was alive in the 17th century, Champagne still produced still wines and largely still red wines. And he was really good at kind of making them better, but actually you didn't want them to referment. And what was happening was wines would sometimes accidentally referment because of fermentation, but wouldn't be finished in autumn. It looked like the wines had finished, but there was still some yeast in there that had gone to sleep. And then in the spring, the weather would warm up, the yeast would reawaken from their dormancy, referment, produce the carbon dioxide, and there'd be like explosions all over the winery
in the summer.
But it would have been a disaster, and it's before the Industrial Revolution, so the glass was quite thin. And this was a nightmare. And actually, they were trying to work out ways of how to not make this happen.
I've got this romantic idea that it just happened by accident, and everyone suddenly started popping corks and was really enjoying themselves. But actually, they had mouthfuls of glass, so it wasn't quite so good.
And again, there's another interesting story which I think has been slightly made up. So there's a sparkling wine.
Don't let that spoil it.
There's
a sparkling wine called Blanquette de
Limoux,
so from the Limoux region, France. And Blanquette de Limoux is pretty much documented, even before Christopher Merritt, the English guy, as being the oldest sparkling
wine.
Isn't
Limoux quite famous for its cows?
I'm going to ignore that. But interestingly, there's Benedict monks at the Abbey in Saint-Hilaire in the 16th century. And again, this guy weaved the story that Dom Pérignon had gone there and learnt how to make sparkling wines, gone back to Champagne, and that's how Champagne became Champagne.
Right.
But I think we can safely say now that's not really what happened. Oh. And the whole Dom Pérignon saying, "Come quickly, I'm seeing the stars," which is the whole
the whole lovely
quote. "Come quickly, I'm seeing the stars" is the quote.
That's my forte.
But that was basically using marketing material found like in the 19th century.
Yeah.
So
what can we believe anymore, Sam?
But there's a couple of legends there. Like, I think clearly Christopher Merritt, he was a scientist and a physician, and he was a really bright guy who not only was the first person to document the additional sugar to make sparkling wine, but he was also produced the first lists of British birds and butterflies.
No way. Now we're talking.
So is your legend Merritt?
No, I think that they're both.
Because it sounds like it should
be. I think it's really Christopher Merritt. It's saying, like, he was a really cool guy who, and in fact, Ridgeview Sparkling Wine have a Cuvée Merritt wine named after Christopher Merritt. And a lovely wine writer, champagne writer called Tom Stevenson was the guy who unearthed the papers about Merritt documenting this. So I just quite like the fact that he was quite unassuming guy who now appears to be the first person to have documented sparkling wine. And Dom Pérignon is also awesome because he did lots of stuff to try and make the wines of Champagne at that time better, but arguably wasn't actually the first person to make champagne.
Mm. But I've got to say, he's benefited from his name. Dom Pérignon sounds... Mm.
Dom, which I think is the name for a monk, right?
So it's not Dominic.
No, he's Pierre.
Pierre. Okay.
Dom Pierre Pérignon.
So, and, whereas Christopher Merritt doesn't sound quite as good, does it?
I mean, and also, you can't get away from the name, right? Like, Dom Pérignon just sounds
awesome.
I know.
It's sort of...
Like, could it be Dom Jones? But it just wouldn't sound the same.
No,
it?
No.
Or Dom...
It doesn't sound
would have been
exotic.
Weird for a Frenchman.
Sandham.
Yeah.
Again.
Not so good.
No.
Just think of a standard French surname. Dom.
Dupont.
quite
Dom
like that
Dupont,
song.
That sounds pretty good as well.
Yeah,
it's just the French, isn't it? They just sound sexy.
Well, see, I could have had my mum's surname.
What's her surname?
Le Bars de Carignol.
Mm.
I would have got a lot more.
Yeah, a lot more action.
Ben Le Bars de Carignol.
No, you still would have looks gone, like you look.
Yeah, I know, but it would have.
In fact, I think you'd have just been inclined to eat more pastry and cheese. You'd have said, but listen to my name.
I'm not going to.
You'd have been
I'm
the size of a house.
I'm going to let the name do the work. Oh, it doesn't seem to
working.
Like that name quite as much as I thought.
So to finish off really quickly, there's a guy who came from the same abbey as Dom Perignon, the Abbey of Hautvilliers. Dom Grussard, who basically, you know, made the whole story up about Dom Perignon making champagne.
What a clever chap.
Yeah.
His name
yeah.
not so good. Grussard.
No, Grussard. G-R-O-U-S-S-A-R-D.
Grussard.
Yeah. And that's it, really. Two guys, two chaps who were very...
I'll tell you what, innovative. Innovative in the world. Because we had a podcast where we were talking about innovation.
Exactly, sparkling wine. Yeah. Both of them were very innovative in their own different ways. Yeah. One in England, one in France, one a household name, the name of a prestige cuvée who actually didn't do anything. And the other guy, confined to the annals of... unknown.
I've got a quick question then. So are these guys in Champagne, are they the pioneers of sparkling wine? So there wasn't someone at the same time doing it, the Carver wines and the Prosecco
wines? Well, no, that's
wines.
The thing. I think in Limoux in France, I think Blanquette de Limoux is widely understood to be the first sparkling wine. So in France, not in Champagne. And the whole thing is that this whole Dom Grussard was amazing because he kind of talked about Dom Perignon and started this basically fairy tale about Dom Perignon, which also gave Champagne massive kudos and made Champagne like the birthplace of sparkling wine. Adverts popped up.
I'm starting to think these pesky French are taking the piss.
I can't believe this. So they, I mean, Champagne is not the start of sparkling wine any more than wherever Prosecco's region is.
Outside Venice,
Benito. So this Limoux place is...
Limoux, so yeah, L-I-M-O-U-X.
We should do a pilgrimage.
And they, make traditional method, champagne method sparkling wines, and I think that's really where
can
it
you
started.
Buy those?
Yeah, you can get them anywhere. Easy to get hold of. Aldi does one, Laithwaite's does one.
Aldi.
Aldi.
lots of different people do. I
start a movement in my... And what are they like, though? Do they taste
they're
like
delicious.
Shit?
No, they're made from slightly different grapes. So where Champagne sort of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and Meunier, it's sort of Chardonnay. Chenin is a dominant grape, and Muzak.
Sweeter, slightly sweeter.
No. Champagne method.
Does it still give you bad breath at weddings? Or?
Yes.
Okay. Well, they didn't sort that out.
So there you have it.
Brilliant one, DP.
Brilliant.
Yep.
Thank you very much, Sam. That was a good Legend of Liquor, and thank you, Tom, for your tequila tasting, and thank you most of all
to me.
Not the listeners. To me, for
how are you
hosting
doing with that pastry?
I'm making my way through it. It's like apple turnover. It's not as good.
It's a bit heavy.
But it's one of my five a day. So there
you
know we
say you end up looking like your pastries, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you are
my heroes.
Indeed looking heavy.
A bit tired. Okay, well, thank you very much for listening, folks. It's been wonderful as ever. And we'll see you next week. Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Bye.
This was a Grand Cru podcast from 7 Digital.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.